it was in 2010 when we started to get approached by every mall. You know, they would show us the outlets and we'd look at the cost of rent, and then they'd tell us, you know, what their spec was in terms of fitting out the place, and that was just astronomical. We were heavily funded and we were like, man, this is going to be, it's got to do well. So that's basically how we got into the malls, and looking back, that was one of our biggest mistakes.
Ask any 10 entrepreneurs, actually any 10 successful people really, what the most important factor in success is, and you can expect 8 of them to tell you that failures are the true stepping stones. But how do you go about learning from failure and helping it actually shape your success? Pull up a chair and join the conversation with Muhammad and Payman Alawadi, founders of Wildpita, who told us a tale of how they truly learned from failure. From Umayya FM, I'm Chirag Desai, and this is Tales of the Trade. Muhammad and Payman, as young boys, grew up in Dera, Old Dubai, as we call it these days. Back when Abras weren't just a tourist attraction, you actually used them to cross the waterways separating the two parts of Dubai, before six-lane roads and skyscrapers lining up Sheikh Zayed Road. And growing up, they actually had an entrepreneurial role model right in the family. Here's Muhammad.
My dad, he had like a couple of businesses. One was an import and export business for denim. So it was called Jean Store. Jean Store. Oh my God, yeah, memories. And then the second business was Sanrio, which is the Hello Kitty brand. So he was the first importer and retailer of Hello Kitty, Little Twin Star, Robbie Rabbit, and then went on to import Garfield and Pink Panther and the Smurfs and the Snorkels. You know, I always tell the story of our dad always making us work in his stores or in his warehouse, and we're merchandising. And we're kids of like 7, 8, 9, 10, all the way through our teenage years and after we came back from university.
So we certainly saw an operation, a business.
This is Payman.
We spent a lot of time in retail. My dad was in retail at the time. We learned how to use the machines. We learned how to count. We learned how to send faxes.
I thought we weren't going to mention the F word.
But also, I think the one major lesson that we learned, and I think this is the most important lesson. My dad, if you look at his clients up until today, every major client that he's had from the last 30 years, still his client today, and they still want to deal with him and nobody else. Because he's got this way, he's built this relationship with people, and they love to work with him.
So when the time came for the brothers to put their own foot forward, they zeroed in on one of the most passionately contested and debated foods in the region, the shawarma. The sandwich that had their own childhood memories deeply entwined with it.
We've been around food for the longest time possible. You know, we always talk about the fact that we're a family that ate at home a lot. You know, my father traveled a lot, and every time he'd come back, he'd bring a piece of the cuisine of the country that he went to, whether it was Taiwan, whether it was Japan, whether it was Singapore. And he would cook those kind of things at home. And my mother is an amazing cook. I think, you know, that kind of trickled down into some of our family members. But it was something that we knew from when we were little, we really wanted to be involved in. We didn't know in what way.
I think we all have like a childhood memory associated with shawarma. So it's something like that's very dear to our heart and something very personal. And if you grow up eating a shawarma from a specific place, then that flavor is what you remember. You know, and I think everybody has that.
Right next to our house in Dera, there was a place called Malik Al Shawarma, and we will never forget that place. A little shawarma place with, you know, one ma'allim shawarma. You know, we'd pass by there regularly and eat his shawarma, and it was amazing. You know, as a 7-year-old, I remember, you know, having that sandwich, unwrapping that white paper, you know, and just taking the first bite with all that tahina. It was just amazing. Like, we could never forget that. And as we grew up, we started to ask each other, like, why is this been exactly the same ever since it probably began? I mean, the ingredients are quite simple. They're like very small in terms of number. And we felt like there was an opportunity there, you know, to kind of put a little bit of a wild twist to it. There's so much. I mean, up until, you know, the recent past, probably everything was imported into this region. You know, we looked at the shawarma and we looked at the Arabic shawarma, and we felt like there was an opportunity to export that in the same manner that today you have sushi all around the world, and it's something common. It's on everybody's like tongue, right?
You'll see that it is probably one of the most popular sandwiches in the world. So in different areas, they give it different names, whether it's a doner or whether it's a tacos el pastor in Latin America, or is it giro or gyro?
Giro.
You know, so it's pretty much the same sandwich, you know, with a different name around the world. It's moved with immigrants and refugees around the world. So it's become so popular. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that doesn't understand what this sandwich is, right? So we thought it would be a great place to start. You know, I think if you think about what is the Middle Eastern sandwich, there's just one.
Now, the brothers didn't want to stop at redefining the concept of the sandwich alone. They also wanted to build a community. For most of us who were active on social media all the way back in 2008, our first sightings of Wild Peter were actually on Twitter. This comic book-like Khaleeji avatar had started interacting with us, building intrigue about this new brand. And remember, this was at a time when companies were only just grasping the power of social media. What is an obvious communication channel today was a pretty rare sight back then, and the community took notice. Paul Castle, popularly known by his online avatar, Daddy Bird, his wife Carla, and even their two cats, Bert and Oliver the Loud, were local celebrities of the Twitter scene back then. If you attended a tweet up at some point in 2008, you've definitely met them. And while they've since moved out of Dubai, Paul still fondly remembers those days and why the Wild Peter community was so successful.
Twitter was unblocked in the UAE at the end of 2008, and very quickly an online community started to form. It was very positive. Many of us got to know people we would not have gotten to know otherwise. Muhammad, with a Wild Peter Twitter account, joined us on that very soon afterwards and became a very active member of our online group and offline group as well. And even though he and Payman were working on getting Wild Peter off the ground at the time and using Twitter to spread the word about it, he was doing it not as other businesses do, just sort of as a megaphone. He was a genuine member of the community, an everyday friend that we talked to online regularly about many things besides the restaurant. They sought input from us, and we'd already enjoyed getting together for meals and meetups, tweetups, frequently all the time, going to many of the classic restaurants in Dubai, Special Astadi, Bukater, Harous Damascus. And so Muhammad and Payman were basically bringing a new classic that certainly had appeal to us right off the bat. Decent location, and it was another opportunity for not just to meet up someplace, but a place where we knew we would be welcome. It was a convenient place to have Emirates and Macintosh user group meetings, quite a few board game tweet-ups. And of course, very memorable were the events that Maserat had in regards to her 8-day academy.
And thus, with a strong community as foundation, their first restaurant now opened in Healthcare City in Dubai, Wild Peter was hustling and bustling, quickly growing to 3 outlets by 2010. Their menu featured fruit juices with no refined sugars and locally sourced veggies in an era of pre-packaged products. And by all accounts, they'd built an extremely successful community. As you heard from Paul, Wild Peter became the de facto location for community meetups. And yet, all was not well with the business itself.
Basically, what happened was we opened our first outlet in October 2009. And then we had the infamous ceiling collapse when it rained in Dubai, and we had to shut down for 4 months. We came back in April 2010, and we had already planned to open 3 outlets in the first year of our operation. That was the strategy that we had in place, and that was kind of what we had agreed with our partners, Dubai SME, at the time. So when we came back in April, we were already working on outlet number 2 and 3, like searching for it and everything. And we opened outlet number 2 in January 2011. Take out the 4 months, is a very short time that we were just in one outlet, because we had to completely shut down for 4 months. And in February 2011, we opened our third outlet, a month apart. And that was not a great move.
The problem was we were just inundated with the problems and challenges of being a startup that scaled too fast. The majority of our time was spent firefighting. So when I say firefighting, I mean the challenges that you face as a startup, you know. And if you add scale to that, when you grow from one outlet to three outlets, you know, and you still don't have a grip on one outlet, and now you have three, that's three times the problems. That's also three times the cost.
I would say it's more like when you go from one to two, it's like 10 times, it's exponential, the issues that we had.
All your time taken focusing on solving these problems. Now, whether they're things like visa challenges or something with your supply chain or something with your product or with your customers or whatever that is, it just completely consumed us. And it really was just Payman and I doing everything. You remember when you would come into Wapita, I would have like that Ma'alim Shawarma knife in my hands. I was shaving meat off the spit, right? I was cleaning the floor. I was cooking in the back. Payman was doing the same. He was in line making sandwiches. You know, he was sorting out our finances. We're interviewing people. We had to do everything. So there came a point where I think it was a year before we closed at the end of 2012, where we made a decision. We're like, we can't go on like this. You know, we were losing a ton of money.
Dubai was growing at an unbelievable pace back then. And with it came the advent of the now infamous mall culture. And whether it was due to the designer brand showing up left, right, and center, or just the sheer summer heat that made it impossible to be outdoors, people flocked to the malls to spend their days and weekends. Shopping, eating, watching movies, all sorts of kids' activities. Naturally, Muhammad and Payman really wanted Walpita to be in a mall.
So with us, we always wanted to get into a mall. Like, it was a dream, right? And initially, none of the malls wanted us. I remember we sent our proposal to every mall and everybody rejected us. And it was in 2010 when we started to get approached by every mall. Like, literally every mall wanted us to be in there. You know, they would show us the outlets and we'd look at the cost of rent, and then they'd tell us, you know, what their spec was in terms of fitting out the place, and that was just astronomical. But in 2010, you know, we were heavily funded, you know, we had huge aspirations, and we were like, man, this is going to be, it's got to do well, you know. We're a young startup, and we said, let's do it. We committed to grow to three outlets. So it was a contract that we had with the Dubai SME, which we said in return for their financial support, we would scale to three outlets. So we had to open three anyway. So that's basically how we got into the malls. And looking back, that was one of our biggest mistakes.
You know, Muhammad and I, we learned everything on the go, right? So when we were looking for locations, you know, we checked out a lot of different streets which had whatever restaurants or shops and things. We did some calculations in terms of numbers. We sat there and we watched. We said, are cars driving by? Are people walking by? And then we did the rounds in the malls and we said, wow, 500,000 people coming through every single day. If we get even a point something percent of it, it keeps us running. It gives us this prestige. We can grow faster. And remember, this all happened at the time where, you know, Dubai was on fast-paced growth, right? So we were in the same actually, everybody in Dubai was in the same mindset. Everybody's like, how fast can we grow? How big can we get? And I think we were in that mindset when we shouldn't have been. We should have stayed with that one outlet. When we look at our first outlet, before we actually had the ceiling collapse, that outlet was super profitable. In hindsight, as Muhammad said, had we stayed there and just ironed everything out, we weren't ready. I mean, when I say super profitable, I'm talking about, you know, 2 months, 3 months super profitable, right? It's not enough time for you to really understand what your business is doing right and what it is not doing right and what you need to fix. The calculations we did, to be honest, Chirag, is we said even if this is a novelty right now and we drop by 50%, we're still gonna make money in this outlet. Which is why we thought if we go to a bigger one with more footfall, we can make more. Yeah. We did it was the wrong formula. But again, we were learning, right? We didn't have anybody to tell us, be careful, go slow, wait, you know, understand everything, understand the numbers.
Don't be stupid.
Yeah, but what to do is it's a lesson learned. If you look at, you know, the three and a half years that we were in operation with the three outlets, there was a very limited time within that entire time, you know, with all three outlets where we actually had a delivery operation. Okay, we almost rarely had it. So I think in the first year, in the first outlet, we had it for a couple of months. We had like one driver, and then we went to two, then we had to cut down. And the reason for that is we always wanted to have that side of the business, which is a big chunk of the business. We just did not know how to operate the restaurant as well as the delivery business. And in hindsight, again, were we able to do that in some form? I think we wouldn't have been in this position. Big lesson for us as well, yeah? And again, it's operations, right? Other restaurants over here, when we just talk to the general public, people talk about 40%, 50%. I haven't heard anybody say less than 40%, to be honest, at least within my circles. Having been able to generate 40% more revenue at that time, that would have changed the entire game for us. But we weren't experienced enough. We didn't have that capability at the time. One thing you have to understand as well, we didn't get to that day where Mohammed was talking about where we said, okay, we think we need to stop bleeding, until after we did a number of different things. I mean, we're guys that really react quickly and try to learn very quickly. So we actually scaled too fast, quickly realized that was not the right move, and we scaled down. We said, this is not working. It's too large for us to handle. We still don't have a grip on all the little things. We're learning as we go. Let's scale down. And we scaled down by the end of 2011. We closed two outlets, and we ended up with one outlet where we put everything we had into the business. Was the last year, and that was when we had, I think, the best food, the best packaging, the best service, and all of that. But we had actually secured, we were going to close down the World Trade Center, and we had found another location that we were going to move to, a smaller outlet. So again, scaling down.
For Mohammed and Payman, there was a small silver lining. Their TV series, Pita Planet, was just starting to come together.
We planned for the TV show for about a year. We were planning because we were traveling to 12 countries and all that. And we came to a stage where we said, should we open another outlet? Again, a lot of learnings for that outlet. You're in a new area and everything like that. It was in Jumeirah 1, just behind the mosque, a nice outlet. But we decided, we're like, you know, we cannot do two things super well. We can only do one at this time.
Pita Planet turned into quite a successful venture and eventually reached 50 million homes all around the world. And then in 2017, over 6 years after they shut down Wild Pita, the brothers felt like it was time to revisit their original idea.
So end of last year, you know, we're just doing an audit of our lives, and we're like, man, there's this brand. It's Wild Pita. It has a ton of value. Are we the only people that see this? I do believe everything happens for a good reason, you know? Even bad things, sometimes bad things happen for a good reason. And the whole time, we did not forget Wild Pita. Our community never let us forget about Wild Pita. Until today, I could be walking down the street, or I could visit somebody in an office, and a random person asks, hey, are you one of the Wild Pita brothers? You know, and they share a story with me. It's like, everybody has a story linked to Wild Pita, or Pita Planet, or both.
When we come back, lessons learned, and Wild Pita rises from the ashes. Welcome back. You're listening to Tales of the Trade and the story behind Wild Pita. This episode is produced by Gaia, and original music for the show was composed by Reiner Erlings. It's easy to talk about failure as something just par for the course. But honestly, what's not easy is to actually deal with it. Watching your dreams just fall off a cliff, or go up in smoke if you prefer that metaphor, dealing with that self-realization, and even having that tough conversation that the business is not working, that's the hard part. And failure can only be a stepping stone for success if you actually evaluate and learn from it. And in late 2016, when Mohammed and Payman felt like they wanted to bring Wild Pita back, they involved the community to help them with this evaluation.
So we asked our community to meet us at a secret Afghani bakery in Jumeirah, and we sat down on a sidewalk and we told them our intention to come back. And they did what our community has always done, tell us the truth. It was very brutal, which is awesome. And I think that's what kept us straight all this time. You know, any time that we were, you know, not focusing on, you know, what we should be focusing on, our community would call us out. And I think that is one of the most beautiful relationships you can have with your community, and something we always respected.
One of the attendees at this meetup, or town hall as they called it, was Shalina Jokir, host of the Declutter Me podcast here on MIFM. And when I checked in with her, I found that Muhammad wasn't exaggerating when he said that the community had been brutally honest with them. In fact, they reminded the brothers about the reasons why Walpita had failed and what they needed to do to be successful for round two.
When they said they were hiring this, I had a feeling that would be the announcement. And when it was made, it was lovely. It's nice to hear. It was a great concept, but it was a few years ago. And when social media wasn't as big, so they made the most of the social media landscape. But that's a regular run-of-the-mill thing now, being on social media. So it's not that bigger concept, you know. And one of the things I said to them was that if they're gonna do this, they need to get a partner that is an expert in F&B, because they're not experts in F&B. They are very good at marketing themselves and building communities. Great with coming up with all these suggestions for the food. I think they have to pare it down, make it a bit more simpler. The other thing was the prices. They were a gourmet shawarma. It was a new thing at the time. It was a new concept. But they weren't marketing themselves as that either, so they weren't getting to the right kind of clients. And so now we have places like City Walk and La Mer, which would be more suited to them and what they serve.
And so, armed with this feedback, they went about searching for an operations partner. But for two brothers who themselves identified that they aren't great with operations and were attempting to rise back from failure, this was actually not easy.
So we approached a lot of people, and as with a lot of entrepreneurs, when you approach somebody to kind of come and invest, you know, we said, we don't only want the money. We're not going to make that mistake again. We want, we want money, but we also want somebody to come and operate this business. And a lot of people said, well, you know, we'll buy you guys out, you know, so they didn't want us to be a part of it, which was a little bit surprising for us. We walked out of that meeting quite quickly. Other people said, well, you know, there's zero value. We can start our own brand from scratch. So we got a lot of different answers, and we were disappointed, to say the least, at that time. We said, look, no matter what happens, we're going to require some funding for this, right? I mean, we're going to need to put some money up. And this was money that, to be honest, we did not have. And so we said, we'll come up with a creative idea, which was the crowdfunding idea.
And suddenly, fortunes changed for Walpita. A few days into the campaign, the brothers received a Facebook message from Freedom Pizza, a locally grown, established delivery brand that had opened around the same time back in 2009, and was now spread all across Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And in Walpita, Freedom Pizza saw a unique opportunity to build and foster a new kind of partnership. Here's Ian Owen, their founder and CEO.
I saw them, their bold campaigns on social media, and in a lot of ways it sort of came full circle to where we first met you guys, which was on social media. And I just thought, well, shit, I should reach out to them and see, and we've always been in touch over the last 10 years, just sort of sporadically and, you know, different things. And so it just seemed sort of like, yeah, let's just throw it out there, you know, and see what happens. And, you know, it wasn't long before we were sitting around in our store in Dubai Marina. All the parts seem to fit together, you know, great product, amazing guys that really are the juice. They got this, you know, amazing brand. And since that time, it's just been, you know, the more I learn about them and the more time we spend together, it makes it very clear that not only is it a good business fit, but, you know, a good business fit also means it's got to be a good personal fit. You know, I think if all of us wanted to work with assholes, we'd still be working in the corporate world. Because you don't get to choose your partner, but we get to choose our partners, and I think I chose well. I want to do things that are meaningful and make sense. We want to do well. We want to serve our customers well. We, you know, of course we want to make money. We're running a business. We want to do it well, but we want to be proud of it.
But I'm curious. Did Freedom Pizza know going into that conversation that this is how this arrangement was going to play out?
No. I think it was just more, you know, and I think as an entrepreneur and as you get more experience, you kind of go with your gut a lot, right? You learn to trust your gut. The elements were absolutely all there. And that's what attracted me to begin with, to start that conversation. And also, I think, you know, they talked about their maturing as business people. I've matured as a business person. I'm sure that this wouldn't have worked 10 years ago. Today, it's the relationship has been very easy because I think we're experienced. We failed. All of us have failed before, but we're still here. And that maturation is important. And I think it'll be a key element to our success in the future.
And, you know, and these guys talk about looking at Freedom Pizza not just as an investment partner, but also as an operational partner, someone that's going to back them. So how do you see this sort of playing out? What's your vision with Valpeta?
I mean, this is going to sound crazy, and this will be either one of those things that people say, what an asshole, or he nailed it, right? So I want to open up hundreds of stores. I think the product is amazing. It's relevant. The mission is clear and relevant. We can bring the operations and the technology and all those things to the table. I see this as, we're going to have some fun while we do it, and we're going to do it in a way that makes sense for us. It's not all about the money, and we have lives and we want to do things the right way. But I see this as hundreds of stores, if not thousands. Because of what we bring to the table, it's been super easy. It's been, we're working hard, but we had a shorthand before we even started to work together. And that is, that's a very encouraging sign. It's very easy to work together. I mean, I find it easy to work with you, maybe you don't.
It took 7 years for us to open up Valpeta. I think a lot of people, maybe they don't know that. So it was 2001 when we came up with the idea. And then when we opened up Valpeta and Dubai SME believed in us, it was surreal. When we became these like weird celebrities on social media in 2009 and until 2012, that was surreal. Leaving that meeting with Ian, it was just surreal. We were a brand. We are a brand. We have a tremendous value, but we were not open. It was basically a brand that was on a shelf that nobody was using. And I want to say there's no perceived value in it. And here's a guy that saw it.
I also see the business model, I also see a product that has universal appeal. I see a product that is healthier, ticks a lot of the boxes of the new brands. I see a business model that has a mission. It's mission focused, and the economics of the units, as we're finding out, and we're also finding out, one of the things that we expected, but we didn't realize how much, but the synergies, the operating synergies between Freedom and Valpeta are actually pretty enormous. They're much more than, we all had a gut feeling, we were kind of hopeful, but it's much, much more than we thought, and we're still learning more about that. But that creates also interesting opportunities for twinning concepts and for doing other things. And it's relatively inexpensive to set up. It's the break-even will be relatively low, particularly in a twinned concept. We can do multiple formats. So it, for me, and I think for the guys, we've talked about this a lot, it has a lot of legs. But to be honest, one of the key reasons, that was one of the key initial draws, was this opportunity to learn, because they are so good at what they do, the way they curate the communities, the way they market, the way these guys are, like I said, they're the juice, right? They're it's kind of a bit of a yin and a yang thing, and that makes us both stronger. And I think we're all mature enough to kind of know what we each of us brings to the table and where we can learn from each other. And I think that is the key to what we're doing. And the learning is probably one of the most important things.
Construction for that first Valpeta twin store began in April 2018, less than a month and a half after that first meeting, and the store itself opened in August. You've been listening to Tales of the Trade from Amaya FM. If you've enjoyed this episode, do leave us a review and tell your friends about us. We're available in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and even in streaming apps like Spotify and Angami. You can also follow us on Instagram for more content. So many tales to be told, so many stories to be shared. Pull up a chair and join the conversation. We'll see you in 2 weeks.